The end of life is nothing new, to say the least, yet it seems as foreign to most of us as a trip to another galaxy when it happens. It's the great unknown, for one thing, but there are other explanations and strategies for coping and even embracing this time in our lives and in the lives of those we love. They are encompassed in a new documentary. It's called Consider the Conversation. Joining us now is Michael Bernhagen. He's Director of Community Engagement and Care Partner Relations with Rainbow Hospice Care in Jefferson, Wisconsin, and he's also co-producer of Consider the Conversation. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
And also documentary filmmaker Terry Caldestyle. Terry also is a fourth grade teacher in Wisconsin, where he was honored in 2007 as Teacher of the Year. He's the other co-producer of Consider the Conversation. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Good morning, Anne.
Question for listeners. Have you dealt with end-of-life issues of a loved one? Would you like to share your story? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, we'll, of course, post a link to for you to get more information about Consider the Conversation. We'll post that at our website at wosu.org/allsides. We're talking about the end of life, and it's a conversation that a lot of people simply don't have. A few years ago, the Obama administration asked the nation to consider the conversation about end of life by covering the cost of those conversations with physicians and counselors. The proposal was dubbed an effort to legalize death panels and died an ignominious death amid the debate over health care reform. You talked about this culture of death and distrust of the health care system in the film. Michael, can you tell us what you learned about it and if it's changed?
You bet. It's interesting, Anne. We seem to have this don't ask, don't tell policy in the United States as it pertains to end-of-life wishes, talking with patients about them, discovering them, and then honoring them. That is, the medical people aren't asking because they haven't been adequately trained how to counsel patients, and they aren't paid to do it by Medicare or Medicaid or any commercial insurance company. And then we lay people aren't telling because we don't know how. We lack the role model, so it's sort of this catch-22 situation. And, I've been a hospice worker for 7 years, and I spend a great deal of my time calling on medical professionals and hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and assisted living facilities. And while I'm there, my goal is simple, to build the depth and breadth of their hospice knowledge and encourage them to play a more active role in managing the needs of those at life's end. And I would say, you know, it's kind of like the 80-20 rule. There's about 20% of medical professionals who get it, who do it, either because they're naturally inclined or hardwired to do it, because they lost somebody close to them, because they've had a lot of experience in their practice. And then there's the 80% that just don't know how to do it and probably won't change their behavior until they're provided with the tools to do it. So we're seeing some progress, but we still have a long ways to go.
We're talking about the end-of-life conversation and also a new documentary out. It's called Consider the Conversation, and I'm talking with the two co-producers, Terry Caldestyle and also Michael Bernhagen. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk a little bit about why we are where we are on all of this. Loretta Downs of the Chicago End of Life Care Coalition explained that death and dying wasn't always so foreign to us in the documentary.
At the turn of the century, the 1900s, half of the children under 12 died, and the life expectancy was 48. So everyone knew death.
So how did we, or when did we, start to unlearn as a culture the process of dying, and helping someone else die? Terry?
Well, it really wasn't that long ago. About 40 years ago, most of us died of heart attacks or cancer or sudden accidents or strokes. And because of the miracle of modern medicine, you know, it's really interesting that because of the great success that our doctors have had, we now have a new problem. And that new problem is now 75% of us will die in a healthcare institution. 50% of us will die in a hospital. And of that 50%, 20% of us will die in an ICU alone, hooked up to all kinds of tubes and machines. 25% of us will die in a nursing home. So what's really interesting is that when, and this is how we open a film, we were out in the streets of New York City, right, and asking, you know, if you had that choice, where would you want to be at the end of your life and whom would you like to be with? And nearly every single person said, you know, now that you ask me, I'd really like to be at home. But the reality is that that's not happening.
And beyond that, they said they want to be at home, and many of them said, I want to be with my loved ones. And that's another thing that isn't necessarily very possible. I think it's Reverend Dale Susan Edmonds of TalkEarlyTalkOften.com talks about how lifestyle complicates things. Let's listen.
It's a different deal now because not only is it more rare that we have to experience death, we've got, you know, such wonderful medical technology that we're shielded in a lot of ways that way, but we're also scattered. We have families that aren't necessarily next door or around the corner in the same house anymore, and so it's a little more awkward to have to pick up the phone to the daughter in California and, you know, talk about these things.
So even if we were willing or able, a lot of us aren't there to do it these days. Michael?
Yeah, we have, you know, there's been sort of a disintegration of the American nuclear family. You know, we're spread out across a broad geography. And so when somebody is dying and they want to live at home, they're going to need that primary caregiving support network, which is usually the family, with the help of some end-of-life specialists, like hospice, for instance. And families, you know, they're just not used to doing that. You know, it's almost as if the shift in where we die from home to the institutional environment, the shift in how we die from primarily a sudden event to this slow incremental process has created a void in our culture, Anne, that is often filled with fear, denial, and the illusion that death is somehow optional. And as Terry said before, I think that part of medicine's struggle at the end of life is due to our success at fighting disease and extending life. So that question is, how can we build that bridge across the void so that people's wishes can come true?
And that was what was part of my education is, first of all, you know, Mike and I, every year we take our kids camping. We leave the wives at home once a year. And he was working in hospice care, and we were talking around a campfire having a beer. And I said, you know, I didn't know anything about this, Mike, you know, and I said, this is really fascinating. You know, someday we should do a documentary on this, and not knowing if it would really happen. But the education for me was not only that what hospice care is, but the whole philosophy of hospice care, because, you know, hospice care isn't a place. It's really a philosophy. And not only did I not know that, but what I learned is that a lot of doctors don't even know that. And so the idea of how do you want to live at the end of your life? And that's a really important piece of this documentary. This film is not about death. It's about how do you want to live before you die. And I think that's an important distinction.
And you can't get there if you don't talk about it.
Exactly.
Because we make a lot of assumptions about each other.
And you know, so one of the things we point out in the film is, number one, you got to talk about it. And it would be impossible to watch this film and not react to it. And what we saw in a premiere, which was on a freezing cold day in February in Wisconsin, 750 seats sold out, which really, really surprised us. But what happened after the film, when normally a movie is over, everybody gets up and walks out, they didn't leave. And the noise was incredible because they were all talking about their personal experiences and their personal wants. And we, on the website, on our homepage there, we have, you know, we interviewed people in the foyer. And, I mean, you can hear the energy in the place. And it's almost as if we lifted this burden. It's like, you know what, it's okay to talk about this. Because it's not like we don't think about it. Because we're surrounded by it. But it's really a taboo subject in our culture.
I know the film is airing on PBS stations around the country, not at WOSU. It's not scheduled. But you mentioned that the premiere was in a community situation. Is that a good way to see it? Versus alone in your living room watching it on television?
Absolutely. It's incredibly powerful when you watch this documentary on the big screen with surround sound. When I was sitting there watching the film in the theater that night, I could literally feel the emotion of the audience as they bore witness to the struggle of patients and families and those that care for them at end of life. There were moments, Anne, where there was complete and utter silence as they were trying to process what they were seeing and hearing on the screen. And there was laughter. There were moments of disdain. There were gasps. And toward the end, there was ultimately a standing ovation. And you know, it's like going to any good movie. You know, you experience what others experience, and that lifts up the entire experience for you as an individual.
What about the conversation afterwards? Do you see in some places are they having moderated conversations about it? In other words, not just among themselves, but somebody leading a conversation to really talk about this as a community? Or is really the community, what kind of value does a community bring to the conversation?
Go ahead, Mike.
What we did at our premiere, and was immediately after the film, I moderated a panel discussion that included several people featured in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several prepared questions. And then we took questions from the audience. And what's interesting is that the amount of time that we had allotted for that panel discussion, including audience Q&A, it ran over because there were so many people waiting in line to share their stories. It was an amazing thing. It's something that we didn't anticipate. And we repeated that experience in a town north of Milwaukee here in Wisconsin 3 months later, and then near Sacramento in California. And each time this process repeated itself, and it's as if people have been hungry for permission to talk about this. They're not getting it from the places you think that they would get permission. And so our film has become sort of the catalyst for that, not only the individual conversation, but the community conversation.
We're talking about a new documentary film. It's called Consider the Conversation, with the co-producers Michael Bernhagen and Terry Caldestal. If you have a question or comment for either of them, we welcome them. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also get us on Facebook at the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Weekday mornings, prepare for the day with NPR's Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne, and hear local news updates from the award-winning WOSU News team. Listen to Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. 86 degrees in downtown Columbus. We'll get up to a high of 95 today. With the heat index, it's going to feel like 101. There's also a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm this afternoon and tonight. An overnight low of 75 degrees. Another sunny and hot day for Thursday with a high of 98.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Symphony as they welcome the Spinners for a soul-infused night of hits this Saturday at Picnic with the Pops, July 23rd on the lawn of Chemical Abstract Service. Tickets and details at picnicwiththepops.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about that end-of-life conversation. We're inspired by the documentary Consider the Conversation, and we're talking with the two co-producers of the film, Michael Bernhagen and Terry Caldestal. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. James Cleary, he's director of palliative medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics, and he'll be joining us later. He said that we need a culture change.
So I think normalizing some of this, encouraging the normality, that's something we need to do and change the culture. Again, it's a radical cultural shift, and it's just going to take time chipping away.
What are your expectations for a time frame for this culture change? And is it important that it happen quickly?
Well,
Terry?
Yeah, this is Terry. I don't think it's going to change quickly. You're never going to turn on a dime when you're talking about a culture. However, you know, this is the part that really surprised me, because initially, what happened, the way I got involved in this, you know, I was talking to Mike around the campfire that one day, but what really, the tipping point for me was, as being honored as a state teacher of the year, one of the things you do is you meet the president in the Oval Office. And when I walked out, the first thing I did is I called my mother, like any good son would do. And then when I got outside the gates, my wife said, you know, you want to take the bus back to the hotel or do you want to walk? I said, you know what, let's soak up the moment, because it's one of those rare, you know, I was never going to have that opportunity again. So I walked down the corner, I called my oldest brother, Pete, and waiting for the light turn. And I'm telling him this incredible story about going through the White House and the Oval Office. And one of the things that happened is I snuck in my phone and I called my fourth graders and I said, what do you guys want to know? I'm about to meet the President of the United States. I'm in a Roosevelt room. And they said, how soft is the carpet? Right. And so it was all these little details. And my brother Pete's not reacting to it. And I said, Pete, what's going on? You know, everything all right? And he said, you know, I know there was a big day for you and I didn't want to rain on your parade, but about 3 weeks ago, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So that was the beginning of my education on end-of-life care and watching my brother go through it. So initially, the audience was families and patients. But as we started working through this, what I found is that doctors kept telling us, the doctors we interviewed, like Dr. Cleary, is that, you know what? Doctors don't know. We are really good at curing people, but we're lousy at treating people that can't be cured. And I never would have guessed that if I hadn't jumped into this project. So one of the beauties of this film is, and which was our goal, is to get people to talk about it, but we didn't realize how well it was going to work. And like I said, at the premiere, it was just so loud. And so I've gotten emails from people around the country that say, I sat down with my father and we watched this thing, and we have never talked about any of these things. And so number one, it's gotten people to talk about it. But the other part, which is what Doug Smith, who's one of the people in the film, is you also have to listen, because that's an important lesson as well. So is it going to change? I think it is going to change. You know, the president's talking about it. It's out there, and every now and then it keeps getting beaten down. But one of the things that we did, and it was really important to us, is we stay out of the politics. We stay out of the religion of the whole thing. I think it's a spiritual film, but it's not a religious film. And it's a human film. And I think that's a great starting point.
I know that your film was shot on a shoestring budget, and to save money, I imagine you used a lot of stock images. But there's a lot of old family videos that are shown in the film, and I wondered where those came from, and also why so much emphasis on those families and children and happy times. That's pretty much permeates the film.
Yeah, that was real important. I mean, because it's about family and, you know, what really matters in your life. And so my kids are throughout this whole thing, and there's neighbor kids that are throughout this whole thing, and there's stuff back in the 60s. And I wanted to keep that focus, that it's not about death, that this is really a film about life.
John in New Albany, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a very interesting show. I just wanted to share with you that my wife and I have gone through the process of losing both of our mothers and my mother in particular, last year. But one of the interesting things that caught me when I started listening to the program was, you know, where did the conversation take place? Well, for my wife and I, interestingly enough, our most recent conversation about that was with our financial advisor. Because there you come to grips with your assets, and you come to grips with, you know, there is a good chance that you will live longer. There is a good chance that you will have more things that you will be able to do. But suddenly, towards the end of life, if you're dealing with chronic issues, there's a real good chance that you're going to use up, you know, what is it, 60, 70% of your assets in the last, I don't know, 8, 12 months. And that, you know, we weren't talking in the sense of you know, trying to put a value on life. Our financial advisor is a good friend and has been for 20 years. But it was more of us talking with each other about the material problems that we face as you age. The other interesting thing, though, that bothers me as I was listening to your conversation, your guest made it very clear that your documentary is more spiritual. I like to think I'm devout, and one of the things that scares me a little bit is that, with the exception of your family unit, assuming you have a good, strong family unit, loving and honest, I sense that there will be a small groundswell eventually that will kind of put pressure on elderly people who are chronic, who have chronic disease, who fall and break a hip, who require surgery, et cetera, and like that, but are consuming medical resources and funds. I sense that there will become some sort of cloud over their existence. And euthanasia is a filthy word, but it's a nice legal term also.
That's an interesting idea. Is having the conversation part of dealing with that?
Yes. Here's what we learned while interviewing Dr. Elliot Fisher, who is the nation's leading expert on variation in the quality and cost of health care delivered in the Medicare population. Elliot told us toward the end of our interview, you don't have to look any farther than your own state, Mike and Terry, to find the best community in the United States at having the conversation. It's in La Crosse, Wisconsin. There's an organization there, Gunderson Lutheran Health System, and a gentleman by the name of Bud Hammes, who's a clinical ethicist with that organization, who 20 years ago started the nation's most prominent advanced care planning program called Respecting Choices. And so he's in our documentary, of course. And toward the end of our interview, I asked Bud point blank. I said, Bud, you make it seem so easy. It took you 20 years to change the culture and the systems of your community and of your healthcare organization. I just have one question for you. If Medicare is not paying you to have these conversations, if Medicaid's not paying you, if no commercial health insurance company is paying you to have these conversations, then why are you doing it? And Bud, you know, he broke down and he said, Mike, you got to understand that La Crosse is a small town, and the communities that we serve are all small towns. The people that we care for here are our friends and our family and our neighbors and our coworkers. We do it because it's the right thing to do. And it was a beautiful answer. It didn't make the film. But you know what? The sad reality is that for every Gunderson Lutheran Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin, there's 50 other health systems who will not change their behavior, will not change their culture, will not change their systems unless they are paid to do it in a fee-for-service system that rewards us for doing more to people but doesn't pay us to counsel them, does not hold us accountable for the quality of the care that we deliver. So, yes, culture change will take time, but here's something that everybody can do, every individual listening in the audience today, every physician, every nurse, every social worker in the clinics and the hospitals and the nursing homes. You can make a difference, one person, one conversation at a time. There's an author by the name of Dr. Joseph Buzak. He wrote a book called Inside the Physician Mind, Finding Common Ground with Doctors. He's out in Idaho. And most of his book was over my head, Ann, because it was so complex, but he gave an incredible definition of excellence that I think applies to this situation. He said, appreciate that excellence is a form of deviant behavior. You become excellent because you're doing things that normal people don't want to do, and that represents a statistical truism. For any observation to be seen as different from others, it must exist outside of two standard deviations of the mean of the population of observations in question. Distinctively, exceptional behavior therefore represents deviancy. So, yes, it will take time to address the imbalance that exists between the two poles of life in terms of medical education, to change our fee-for-service system, to put systems in place to give medical people the tools that they need to do this better. But that change can begin today with an individual commitment.
I was going to add that, you know, the caller's point that, you know, are we snuffing people out early? You know, are they saying that they're a burden in our society?
Or that there'll become a groundswell of that as,
right,
you know, we have these conversations.
And I really believe that this isn't a political or a financial issue. That if you ask people, how do you want to live at the end of your life? The majority, high majority of people are going to say, I don't want to be connected to 1,000 tubes and 1,000 machines in an ICU and die all alone in pain. I don't want to do that. I want to be surrounded by my loved ones, and if I have the opportunity, I would love to be at home, the place that matters most to me. And so all of those financial issues and all those political issues just go away. And but we'll never get there if we don't have the conversation. If somebody says, and we don't give the answers, we're just trying to provoke people to talk about what they want. But if somebody says, you know what, I want to be kept alive like Stephen Hawking to the bitter end, then more power to you, because we have that ability to do that. But if somebody else says, you know what, I want to die a natural death, which has really become a natural in our culture, then I think we should give them the opportunity. That's not euthanasia. That's just, you know, dying a natural death.
Thanks, John from New Albany, for that call. We're talking about end of life in the conversation, and we are inspired by the new documentary. It's called Consider the Conversation with Michael Bernhagen and Terry Caldestel. Ruth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is a great conversation. I just wanted to say that I have been enormously privileged to be there at the end of the life journey with several close friends. One of them, I did everything in my power to honor his wishes to socialize and do things as much as possible, even in his very, very weakened state. And he only spent one day in the hospital at the end of his life. And I was just very, very privileged to see how he lived his life absolutely to the fullest, every drop that he could, even when he could barely get out of bed. I also was there with my grandmother a couple of years ago. On the last day of her life, my mother and I sat with her almost all day. I find it extremely life-affirming to accompany people in this way. And I only hope that someone is with me in the same way. And I also wanted to recommend a book to your listeners. It's called How We Die by Sherwin Nuland, which I'm sure you must be familiar with. And I'll hang up now and you can comment.
All right, Ruth. Thanks for the call.
I'd like to comment. One of the things that I also have the privilege of doing as a longtime hospice worker is meeting with patients and families when they approach that fork in the road. In other words, they've been presented with a terminal prognosis by their medical providers, and they have to decide, okay, am I going to continue to fight this thing, or am I going to go in the direction of something like hospice care? And earlier this week, we're short a social worker here this week, at Rainbow Hospice. They sent me up to a local hospital to meet with a gentleman in his mid-80s. He was a truck driver, Italian, the patriarch of his family, real tough guy, and his family members. And I was sent there to talk with him about his situation, asked him what his wishes were. We talked about hospice, et cetera, et cetera. And the whole time I'm doing this, I'm holding his hand. And we spent about 2 hours together. And toward the end of our visit, he said, Mike, you know, thank you for taking the time to meet with us and to explain things. And he asked me this question, do you know what it means to be a man? And I said, excuse me? He said, a real man is somebody who will hold the hand of a dying person in their bed. And it profoundly impacted me, because that's really what it's all about, as Ruth indicated, is being present for people. People, when I meet with patients and families at the end of life, I've found them to be just deeply appreciative of anyone willing to take the time to listen and provide wise counsel, because they haven't gotten that timely and comprehensive counseling, when they weren't, at the edge of the falls. And that's one of the things that La Crosse, Wisconsin, Gunderson Lutheran has done so well. 96% of all people, when they die in La Crosse, Wisconsin, die having completed an advanced directive. But far more than just completing that legal document, they've had a series of timely and comprehensive conversations with their medical providers, with their family, with their clergy. And as a consequence, the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare has found that they have the least expensive healthcare costs in the final 2 years of life in the United States. And that's not because they're withholding care from people. It's because they're having the conversation when people are not dying. And people are getting the type of care that they want. As Terry said earlier, if they want every aggressive treatment, if they want to get into an experimental clinical trial, they're going to get it. But guess what? They found out that most people who are older and who are dying slowly and incrementally would prefer to be at home, be kept comfortable, and have quality time with those that they love. And that's what they're getting. So it is the conversation done in a timely and comprehensive manner that is allowing people's honors wishes to be discovered and honored in that community.
There's something you've brought up a couple times about just being there and listening, and that can work magic. And it reminded me of the hospice worker that you interviewed who talked about the man named Jack, who was a magician and decided to end his life on his own terms. And I don't want to blow the film too much, but it was a great story, and I was wondering if one of you would relate that.
You know, that story...
And I also wonder how he told it without, you know, tearing up and...
Well, let me tell you, both Mike and I were sobbing at the end of that point, and it's not a sad story at all. There's nothing sad about it. It's just, but it is a very emotional story. And the point of that story is really that we need to listen. And it's one thing to talk, but it's another thing to listen. I have a 90-year-old father-in-law, and he's suffering all kinds of things, from heart disease to cancer. And that's the way most of us are going to die. You know, it's a slow process, and it's not just going to be of one thing like it was 40 years ago. But last summer, we're sitting out on the deck looking out at the lake, and my daughter walks by, and she's talking about this play that she was in at the local high school. And he said, "Did I hear you say you're in a play?" And she says, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I want to go." And then his wife, my mother-in-law, said, "No, Chuck, you know, you don't want to go. You're not going to be able to hear. You know, he's lost most of his hearing." And he goes, "No, if my granddaughter's in this play, I want to go." And then my wife says, "Chuck, you really, you're not going to even like the play. You know, you really don't want to go." And he said, "You know, God damn it, if my granddaughter's in a play, I want to go." Well, the fact is, the guy's 90 years old, right? He had 9 children. If he wants to go to a play and leave early, then you take him to the play, and then you take him home early. If he wants to go to the play and then complain about it the whole way home, you take him to the play and you let him complain about it the whole way home. At this point, he should get what he wants. And I think it's that point of listening. It's one thing to start the conversation, but we also have to listen. And one of the people that we met in California who previewed it and gave us some feedback early on was so angry at his father, because what his father wanted was not what he wanted. And Marty Welsh, the doctor, the family practitioner who has since died of ALS that's in the film, he makes that point. He goes, "You know, my family is not ready to let go of me." He says, "But this is what I want." And I think that's an important piece that Doug really points out in the film.
We have an email from Barb. She says, "I wish Mom would have opened up more about dying. She didn't share anything, but then again, we didn't ask. It would have helped me to know what it feels like to be dying. I guess it is a very personal thing, but I think when and if I find out I am terminal, I will share with my family, if they don't mind, of course. My mom was blessed to have me to take care of her throughout her many illnesses and broken bones, and she was blessed to be able to die in her own home with care from hospice. She slipped away while one of her daughters and daughter-in-law was ordering pizza."
And that's what our film, it's a tool to start that conversation.
We are talking about end of life in the conversation. There is a documentary out there. It's called Consider the Conversation. We'll have a link on our website so you can learn more about Consider the Conversation. We're talking with Michael Bernhagen and Terry Caldessel. I think that one of you is leaving us after at this point.
I'll believe it. Mike will be staying with you.
Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Coming up, we'll hear from Dr. James Cleary. He was interviewed for the documentary. He's director of palliative medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The new documentary, Project Nim, is about the controversial experiment to raise a baby chimp named Nim as a human baby and teach it sign language. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from James Marsh, the film's director, Jenny Lee, who was 13 when her mother became Nim's surrogate mother, and Bill Ingersoll, who befriended Nim when Nim was sent to a primate facility. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Friday night on WOSU-TV, Appalachia, History of Mountains and People continues as the region confronts a strange new industrial age, with the railroads pushing ever further into the mountains. Foresters, botanists, geologists, novelists, and historians all recount the changes in the land and its people as the coal is dug and the ancient trees are cut down to fuel the nation's booming new industrial age. Watch Appalachia, A History of Mountains and People, Friday night at 10:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
Sunny skies today and a few clouds. Clouds increasing this afternoon. There's a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm due to the heat, a high of 95 today. With the heat index, it feels like 101. Partly cloudy tonight with a chance of pop-up rain and a low of 75 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the end of life, how we can manage it for ourselves and our loved ones with Michael Bernhagen. He's co-producer of a new documentary on the topic. It's called Consider the Conversation. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you.
Also joining us now is Dr. James Cleary. He is interviewed in Consider the Conversation. He teaches medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, and he is also director of palliative medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. Welcome, Dr. Cleary.
Thanks very much for having us, Anne.
How did you learn how to deal with the end-of-life conversation with your patients?
Basically, I learned from watching others. And I think that's the experience that we find in surveys, that where did most oncologists actually learn how to do end-of-life care, palliative care? It was from watching others. But then if you actually ask the oncologist, some 70% of them will tell you that they never had any education. I was lucky enough to have good mentors who led very well by example. I think there are many of us who've learned the wrong way how to do these things because our colleagues have not had any training or experience in this. I would come back and say I've had very good mentors, including both my father as physician and my mother who was a hospice nurse.
When palliative care is a relatively new field, we were talking earlier about how physicians aren't taught about this in medical school. What do you learn when you are taught about it?
So it's actually not new. And if I can, hospice has actually been an excellent provider of palliative care for many, many years in this country.
Yes.
But when the hospice benefit came out in the 80s, it was actually then the modern hospice movement started. That was created outside of our standard medical care. It was somewhat of a reaction to what we were doing as a healthcare business at that stage, and I'll use the term business profession. So hospice was a reaction to the way healthcare was providing. So they've been this wonderful provider, but living outside of many healthcare systems. What hospital-based palliative care is now doing is bringing this back into healthcare systems, and to some extent, in working with hospices, is really becoming a disruptive innovation in terms of changing the way we look at healthcare. And that's been a significant factor. As we do this, we're having to educate physicians on communication skills. How do you break bad news? How do you manage symptoms for people? How do you address bereavement and psychosocial issues? And then how do you actually care for someone who's in the active stages of dying? Many of us would just call palliative care or hospice that active stage of dying. We see it as being much, much more than that.
We're talking with Dr. James Cleary. He's director of palliative medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. And Helen, you're a hospice worker. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I would like to comment on everything, but I know there's that. Going kind of backwards, palliative care, symptom control, in hospice, people, that's what we focus on, are people's symptoms and controlling them, and people tend to be very comfortable. I wish that palliative care could be a bigger part of general medical care because it's so effective, and as, you know, we get older, sometimes it seems like that is probably the best type of care we could get. Initially, I was calling to say that when I admit families to hospice, they often say that when the time comes, you know, they want their family member to go to a respite or something like that. And without exception, people become comfortable. providing care and symptom relief, and it becomes a very natural and welcomed event at home. Another thing is there's a document called Five Wishes that is helpful in a living will, and it's where the individual can say what they want, you know, how they want their life to be. And it's I don't believe it's a legal document, but it certainly helps the family to plan ahead. And
okay,
I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Wonderful program. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Helen. And if I may,
sure.
I may jump in a minute here. You know, earlier I mentioned from time to time I get to meet with dying patients and their loved ones. And one of the things that I've learned from terminally ill patients, and this is an important lesson, most of them are not afraid to die. What they're afraid of is the dying process. By that I mean, you know, some of the fears they have include, am I going to suffer? Am I going to die alone? Will I be a burden on my family? Will I have to leave my home? Will I leave unfinished business? You know, whatever that might mean to them. Will my doctor still want to see me? Will he or she abandon me? And I think this is where hospice and palliative care can be part of the solution, you know, part of answering those questions to alleviate people's fears. We certainly have the ability to manage pain and symptoms from a medical perspective. The most important work falls into that bucket of completing unfinished business. That's what Dr. Ira Byock, who's the director of palliative medicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, who's in our film, talks about in his book, The Four Things That Matter Most. That's the most important work to people at end of life, saying, thank you, I'm sorry, I forgive you, thank you. And, you know, people can't do that unless their pain and symptoms are well managed. And that's where hospice and palliative medicine can be so valuable.
Dr. Cleary, it was brought up early on in the program that the doctor often is treating the family, that a lot of the conversation is with the family, and that's often, you know, Mike just made the point that people are usually ready to die. It's, you know, a lot of other stuff, and the family sometimes isn't ready to let go.
I would agree with that. When we have medical students rotate through with us, and that's one of the important exposures they get, I remember we asked them to write a reflection. And one of the students wrote that Dr. Cleary went into this room and the family was really trying to convince Dad to have a therapy. And Dad didn't want to have the therapy. And Dr. Cleary had the discussion with Dad and the family got to hear Dad's voice. And I didn't do anything clever in this conversation except really redirect the focus back to Dad and encourage the family to hear Dad. And Dad spoke with this somewhat frail, but he came even stronger when he said, guys, just keep me comfortable. I don't want any more treatments. And that was tough for the family to hear, but that's a lot of our work. But I would say that that's a lot of the work that happens in intensive care units around the country. As we educate people on what's happening, it even is happening in emergency rooms, although physicians don't really have the time to have those discussions. They're often forced to be educating people even in emergency rooms. So what I think Consider the Conversation is doing is say, guys, let's bring this forward. Let's bring this out of the brink of death care situation. Let's discuss our values. Let's discuss our wishes much, much earlier in the process.
If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. We're talking about end-of-life conversation and about the documentary Consider the Conversation with Michael Bernhagen. He's Director of Community Engagement and Care Partner Relations with Rainbow Hospice Care in Jefferson, Wisconsin. He's also co-producer of Consider the Conversation. And also Dr. James Cleary, he teaches medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, and he is Director of Palliative Medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. Caller from North Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question, comment, about the last 24 hours or so of end-of-life care. It relates to the practice of not providing any moisture or any kind of liquids to somebody who is not able to speak. There, I've had this happen with two different relatives and so forth in the last few hours of their life. When they're still awake, they're still in and out of consciousness, and their mouth is like bone dry, like it is out on the highway today. and you're not supposed to give them any kind of assistance with respect to moisture or ice or liquids or anything. Like, I just think that is completely inhumane to not allow somebody to die in comfort, because they're dying anyway. And all you're doing is trying to speed up the process so that somebody can go home or something.
Is that?
And, I wonder if you comment on that.
Is that typical?
To me, that's not typical at all. And in actual fact, one of the things, the issue that we get in discussion is whether we should be giving IV, intravenous fluids, fluids through the veins to people at the end of life. And there's not a lot of evidence to support that we actually correct the symptoms of dehydration at that stage. The way to correct the symptom of dehydration is to actually apply regular swabbing, and we use and encourage families to keep the mouth moist. So we actually encourage them to do that. It's actually a nice activity to be engaged in. And people say, well, why don't you give fluids? Just like today, when you're outside, your mouth becomes dry regardless very quickly after having a drink. In fact, with people mouth breathing near the end of life, their mouth is often very dry anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's swabbing them, keeping it moist, regular. We encourage that. And ethically, on the principle I think that the caller is addressing, yes, they are going to die. There may be a small risk that they aspirate some fluid into the lungs, but it is clear liquids, it's water. That's not going to cause that much problem. Our primary focus is actually keeping them comfortable. Comfort should be the focus.
Thanks for that call from North Columbus. And Tom and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a brief comment. For me, quality of life is more important than the length of life. And quality of life can only be measured by each individual themselves. And hopefully the day will come when a person will be able to end their life with assistance and dignity. That's my comment.
Thank you very much for that call, Tom. One of the subjects, and you brought him, I think, up earlier, is the physician who was dying of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah, Dr. Martin Welsh. Thank you for your call, Tom. One of the central figures in Consider the Conversation is a family practitioner who lived in Northern California by the name of Marty Welsh. And he initially came to our attention in the late summer of 2009 when his beautiful editorial entitled 100 Things Leading to a Single Choice appeared in the Los Angeles Times. And in that editorial, Marty defined what quality of life means to him from both the perspective of having been a doctor caring for people at end of life, and now from his unique perspective of being a patient dying of Lou Gehrig's disease. And basically what he said is, imagine that quality of life is a list of 100 things that you do most days. Some are routine, some are chores, some are pleasurable, like, you know, getting out of the bed and walking to the bathroom, kissing your wife, answering the phone, driving your car to work, you know, playing golf with your friends, hugging your child, etc. And he says, you know, of course we do many more than 100 things each day, but for now, just imagine 100 that are essential to the life that you live. Now, if you take away one, you can still do 99. Is life still worth living without being able to smell the rose in the garden? Of course it is. How about losing 2 or 7 or 23? Is life still worth living? Of course. But, he says, suppose you get to the point where you've lost, say, 90 things, and now with each thing taken away, a bad thing is added. You know, life is still worth living, but you're getting tired. So he says at some point, no matter who you are and how strong, you're going to lose enough things that matter and acquire enough negatives that the burdens of living will outweigh the joys of you know, going. And so, you know, that's the point when, as a doctor, he would reassure his patients and families that they'd fought the good fight and it was now okay to accept moving on to the next phase. And so what Marty is talking about in 100 Things is the fundamental ethical question in 21st century America when it comes to end of life, and that is, how are we to reconcile that friction that now exists between increased quantity of life brought about by advances in medical technology and treatment and the reduced quality of life that often accompanies it? And Tom is exactly right. That answer will vary from person to person. And without that conversation, without that contemplation, you're going to find yourself in a crisis, and it's hard to think straight in those situations. So what does quality of life mean to you is the essential question.
Marsh, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Just a quick comment. my mother passed away in January of this year, and we did bring in a hospice team. It was very interesting for us because we, you know, mom had exactly what was said earlier. She said, look, I'm tired. I just want to go home. I want to be in my own place. I understand. And the family got there. The interesting thing was the hospice team really helped us get there with the rest of the medical team. The rest of the medical team was so dedicated to taking care of her and trying to get her better and fighting the issues that they were fighting and had fought a phenomenal fight. And it was really interesting because they weren't really ready to let go yet when the family and my mother were. And the hospice team was nothing less than miraculous, an incredibly special group of people who came in and really helped bridge that gap, in our case, between the family and the medical team. And, you know, it's a tough situation to go through, but anybody who has an opportunity to work with a great hospice team will have a unique experience in life. And that's my comment. I'll go offline.
For your loss, Marsh, and thank you very much for
your
call.
You know, Marsh makes an important point, and that is with something like hospice and palliative medicine, it's certainly about what's going on with the body, you know, trying to manage those symptoms, keeping the patient comfortable, but it's far more than that. It's about what's going on with the mind, the spirit, the soul, and the relationships that exist within that family unit between husband and wife, between parent and child. And indeed the relationships between the medical providers and the patient as well. And it's a nice bridge.
Chris in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call, Ann. We lost my wonderful father January of 2010. And he'd had heart disease and COPD, and he knew that the end was near. And he just did a marvelous job, just like he lived his life. At the end, there's so many people came up to us during the calling hours and said, I hadn't talked to your dad in 5 years, and he called me 2 weeks ago just to see how I was doing and check on me. And, I mean, so many people, and he knew. And he sat us all down at Thanksgiving before his death and said, I forget his exact words, but something to the effect of the amount of money that is spent at the end of life trying to keep somebody alive. He said, you are absolutely not to do that. So when his heart was failing and my brothers do not live in the state, they had to get here. You know, we contemplated, do we go ahead and try to keep him alive, if you will, until my brothers arrive? But we said, no, you know, he told us he didn't want this. And he was not going to regain consciousness. So there was no point. And I'm just so glad that he took the time to tell us that. And that he ended his life talking to people that mattered to him and reconnecting with people that he hadn't, you know, talked to. And I just think he did it right.
Chris, this sounds kind of odd to say, but I'm happy for you.
You know, it was, you know, the toughest thing I've ever been through in my life, but he was a remarkable man all the way to the end.
Thank you, Chris, for that call. I want to also thank my guests for the conversation today. Michael Bernhagen, he's co-producer of Consider the Conversation, and also James Cleary, he's a doctor. He's director of palliative medicine at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. Thank you for talking with us today, folks.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much, Ann, and I can tell you I enjoy the work I do, as much as it may sound strange.
Thanks again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.